History recording at Westminster School on Monday the 19th of August 2019 with Elizabeth Wells, archivist, and
Richard Hitchman.
Richard, I was hoping we could start by talking a little bit about your family and your mother and your father and what they did for a living.
Okay, yes. My father was a career civil servant. He became a permanent secretary and then finished his career as deputy chairman of the Atomic Energy Authority. My mother was American. She went to Bryn Mawr, and then my grandfather, who was a lawyer in New York, sent her and her sister off to Bryn Mawr to Oxford to read law. And a good friend of hers at LMH had a brother at Cambridge who had been at school and was at Cambridge with my father, and that's how they met. My mother qualified, was called to the bar in the Middle Temple, but she never practiced. She, I think, helped my... She took another degree at NYU and, I think, helped my grandfather in his law office, but she never really had a career. And she came over a few years after she'd left Oxford to see English friends and met my father again, and they got married. And she spent the war here and, in fact, didn't go to America again for another 20 years because it was difficult.
Did you know much about their war growing up? Did they talk about it?
Yes, a bit. I saw a reproduction in Blackwell's last year, or the year before, of the hand-coloured map that the LCC brought out of bomb damage, where it was red for total destruction. Yeah. My father spent the war... I mean, he was private secretary to Ernie Bevin at one point. He was in the Ministry of Labour. So he wasn't called up. He spent the week in Little Marlow, where one of my two primary school teacher aunts was evacuated with her school from London, and he used to commute to London. And then at the weekend he went to a village in Berkshire where the family had a cottage, which was where I spent the first 9 months of my life. And you heard about that. And I can remember saying to my father, well, what about the house? And he said, well, you had to do fire watching once a week. And then every week I used to go to the little house in Chelsea and see if it was still there. And once the door was blown in, but that was all. And indeed, when I looked on the reproduction of the LCC map, there was really slight bomb damage at that end of the street. My mother, I think, had to walk down to... It's a village built around a big circular field. She had to walk across it. She said, because the only phone, public phone, was the other side to call my father. And if a German bomber came over in moonlight, you went under the hedge to make sure that he didn't strafe you. So you heard about that. And she had electricity put into the cottage the week before the war started, because the electricity company said, well, we're a bit full, what out next week? And she said, not in your life, it's going to be a war. And indeed, she and half the village had electricity and the other half didn't until after the war. So, yes, you've heard a bit.
And I know that you haven't had an older brother, because he was also at Westminster.
I had one older brother and no other siblings. Yeah.
Okay. Was it a big age gap between you?
3 years.
Okay. And where did you first go to school before you came to Westminster?
The other school.
Ah, you were at the underscore.
Yeah, yes.
Okay.
Alma mater of Rhys Mogg, the younger.
Hmm.
There we go, yes.
So, but when you were at the underscore, was it still in Little Dean's Yard?
No, it had moved a few years before to Eccleston Square, hence the bit in one of the school magazines. 'Tis the voice of the schoolboy, I heard him declare, I went to a prep school in Eccleston Square. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a takeoff from Lewis Carroll.
And what was the underschool like back then? It must have been quite small.
About 80 pupils, I should think. And I went at the same time as Patrick Campbell, who became headmaster, who was a good guy, and actually his son lives down the street from me in Oxford. Everybody knows everyone. Yes, and the teaching was pretty good, and let's see, three people in my year got scholarships to Westminster. So we were three out of originally six.
Mm. And why did your parents choose Westminster? for you and your brother?
Well, I think because I can remember once being a sort of bit bolshy, saying, well, why, you know, why a private education? Because my father made me take the 11 plus. I'm not entirely sure why. I mean, and I passed it. And I said, you know, I'm not sure I'd do it if I have children. And he said, you will do the same as everybody in your cohort does. So, yeah, they all did. And it was a good education, and we lived in Chelsea, and my brother was a day boy, and I would have been had I not had a scholarship and boarded, which was mostly weekly boarding, and it was a very nice arrangement.
Were you happy to be a scholar and not a day boy like your brother?
Yes, because I went home most weekends. And I enjoyed it. It was all a bit precious. You know, one of the boys who'd been at the underschool with me, you know, would be playing the Beethoven Late Quartets on his LP records. And I remember once having to go to see a specialist in Harley Street. I had an ear infection. And we were talking about it, and I said, of course, the thing is that, you know, college, it's a bit neurotic. And I meant it more or less as a joke. And he took it quite seriously and said, well, somewhere like that, yeah, it could be conducive to neurosis. I don't know. I never really saw it.
What, do you have memories of taking the challenge?
Yes. Not very strong ones. I can remember there was one question which presumably was designed to see whether you had any kind of instinct for science subjects, which you just didn't do at prep schools in those days. And it was, how does a fountain pen work? Which, well, I couldn't do. But, you know, I mean, my strong point was languages, and therefore I was doing French and Latin and Greek, and I'm sure that's what got me in, because my maths is mediocre.
And what were your first impressions when you did come to the buildings in Little Dean's Yard?
Well, I'd probably seen them before, because I think I'd taken the exam in the Dean's Yard building where the other school was just before I went there. So, and I probably, I know, I may have been there, I'm not sure. Well, yeah, not much. I remember being kept awake until about midnight by Big Ben. And then, of course, you generally got used to it. And my brother came and said hello the first day. And, you know, there were lots of people who'd been at the other school, so it was non-threatening.
What was your dormitory accommodation like at first?
Well, it was six iron bedsteads with six people. It was all right, you know.
And so you'd come with two contemporaries from the underschool,
yeah.
And then you had
three others, and then there was another boy who was originally in Middles and then passed the challenge after he'd been in the school for a year. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Were your friends naturally the boys who you'd come with from the underschool, or?
Well, not particularly then, no. One of my friends then had been to prep school with someone like Devon. He's Kit Harrington's father. I'm a bit lost touch with him. We used to see him because we used to go and stay near where he lived in Worcestershire, see him on the way back to Oxford, and then we did. But yes, nice guy. There was a boy called Robert Serpell who was certainly the brightest. He was the Liberty boy, who eventually got a doctorate at Sussex and ended up as Vice Chancellor of the University of Zambia.
And did you feel that you were distinct in your identity as college?
Yes, to a point. But, yeah, I don't think we made that much of it. And in fact, the boy then, man now, whom I've kept up with most, wasn't in college. He was a classicist like me, and like me, his mother was American and had spent the war in Wales, actually. And I always had a bit of a grudge because his family got to Massachusetts in 1635, whereas mine only got there in 1640. So he was a very good friend, and he hadn't been at the other school.
And you mentioned that you enjoyed and were good at languages.
Mm-hmm.
When you arrived at Westminster, what sort of subjects were most exciting to you?
Well, I suppose the languages, French, Latin and Greek. You didn't do history or geography then because they were thought to be. Yeah, anybody can do that. And I was taken on a school trip to Greece when I was 15. And I remember going to see friends of friends of my parents in Athens. And we all spoke French because that was the second language. And I learnt a bit of modern Greek and went several times afterwards and was quite good then, but you know, I've forgotten it now. We were there 2 or 3 years ago, and when we took the taxi in from the airport in Salonika, I think I can understand about 20%, and on the way back, 50%. But I mean, it would come back, but I mean, I was never that good, but I could keep up an ordinary conversation. You know, and that, I don't think anybody particularly encouraged me to, but I think the atmosphere was, well, if you want to learn something, learn it. I mean, it was, particularly if you're a classicist, Theo Zinn, whom I mentioned at the memorial for Peter Bryan, was a brilliant and inspirational teacher. My brother, who did science, complained that, first of all, it was a bit patchy outside classics and history, and second, if they didn't think you were a certain Oxbridge material, they didn't take as much trouble, which I think is probably right, and John Ray mentions that more or less in his autobiography. And my brother went to St. Andrews and passed all his accountancy exams and made a lot more money than I ever did, so he didn't suffer.
You touched on Theo Zinn, and I want to come back to him in more detail later, but I wanted to ask if any other teachers really stand out in your mind.
Not so much, no. I mean, he was the real guru. We were competently taught French and German by Jewish refugees. I mean, that was the real golden era of London, where the flower of German Jewish intelligentsia had gone either to London or New York. And the head of maths was Adolf Prague, who was apparently a brilliant teacher. He was German Jewish. Dennis Moylan was a very good classroom teacher, but Theo was, I suppose, one of the three gurus in my life. The other was a Marxist who taught me Greek history at Oxford, and the third was my eventual supervisor for my DPhil, who was Italian Jewish. And that's a story. She was whisked away by her mother, her father being dead, from Rome when the Germans were rounding up the Jews, and non-Jewish friends hid them, which was common in Italy. The Italians behaved very well. So, you know, I was very lucky to have three really inspirational teachers.
And who, when you started, it would have been Walter Hamilton as the headmaster?
No, he just left. John Carlton, I think it was his first term, my first term. Yeah.
And then who was Master of College then?
Henry Christie.
Okay.
Yeah. Who, again, I think was new to that.
Yes, because Carlton moved on from that role. Yeah. So what were your impressions of those two figures?
Well, John Carlton was great fun. I mean, he took me when I was nominated as captain the summer before. He took me for a drive for a week to go and stay with friends. And he was very social. I mean, he was, I mean, much more than actually most people, because he was pretty solid professional middle class. I think he was quite smart socially. I mean, there were stories about his, beating boys and possibly enjoying it too much. Well, he never beat me, and I never heard much about it. Otherwise, he was okay. I mean, he was great fun, and I think he was probably good for the school. And he had a delightful touch that comes in somebody's memoirs, that he used to wear tweeds to go to Vincent Square, because that ranked as the country. And interestingly, I think his mother was Italian, and I think he was in SOE in the war, but I never knew anything about that. People who do that kind of thing tended not to talk about it. So, yeah, he was fine. You know, I got on very well with him. I liked Henry Christie very much. Nice man, and I think the received wisdom is that Westminster was very lucky that it almost went bust in about 1840, because it completely missed all the Thomas Arnold muscular Christianity bit, and that was still very much, and it was you know, it was neither then city nor landed money like Eton. It tended to be civil servants, doctors, lawyers, people in the arts, particularly theatre. And there was still, I think, the hangover from the 30s when they invited Mahatma Gandhi to come and speak at the school. I mean, it was pretty liberal. And beating and fagging and doffing your cap to monitors, I mean, that really didn't happen. I mean, it was very easygoing. And, yeah.
And who was matron? Did you have a matron in college?
Nadia, I can't remember her last name.
She was also Christy, was she?
No. I assume she was a widow. Nadia, I can't remember her last name, but she looked up. Nice woman, very sort of, could imagine her playing croquet on a vicarage room. No, nice woman, yeah.
So it felt comfortable and homely?
Yes, and I was, as I say, I was lucky I could go home most weekends. David Harrington, whose parents lived in Worcestershire, tended to complain because it meant that he had more than his fair share of being one of the 16 out of 40 who had to be there for Sunday morning service in Abbey. Well, he got over it.
Do you have strong memories of the Abbey and those sort of services in the Abbey?
Yes, I suppose so. I mean, I read the lesson in Westminster Abbey several times. And since I have, as you will have noticed, always liked the sound of my own voice, I rather enjoy it. There's a seminar series at Oxford which has to do, among other things, with Brexit. And there was one morning session at Church House a year or two ago, and I went and was talking to an Australian just emeritus professor of economics from Oxford and said that I'd been at Westminster. And he said, "What a privilege." And I said, "Well, yes, I suppose so." And it's funny, my last job at Kleinwort Benson was as director of compliance for the investment management company, and it was a small team, and three of them I still keep up with, none of whom had been to university, so we used to, and still do on the whole, meet for dinner before Christmas. Last year instead, I had them all with their husbands and wives to lunch at my house, and then I took them on the Hitchman tour of Oxford, which is high on history and low on shoe leather. And my deputy, an extremely nice woman who never went to university, although she certainly would have done a few years later, and did an open university degree in her spare time, she said, "Well, did you find all this intimidating?" I said, "Not really, because, you know, the school chapel is Westminster Abbey, so, you know, what's Oxford? You know, continuation. Yeah, you wore a gown, the same thing."
I've spoken to some people who found the academic side of Oxford a bit of a letdown after Westminster.
Found it pretty challenging. Okay. I didn't get a first in mods by quite a long way, and was told later I hadn't done enough work. And now I would have said, "Why the hell didn't you tell me in time that I could have done?" I just missed a first in greats. Greek history, my guru taught Greek history, and that was okay. Roman history and ancient history, I think if I'd done enough work for the Bible, I'd have got the second half of them I needed. Roman history, my tutor was at Magdalen, delightful chap, but drunk most of the time. And, yeah. So it's damn hard work at Oxford, particularly greats, the last year of greats. You really had to put your back into it. And I went... Well, I was American still until I was 23, and I couldn't take out my scholarship at the University of Pennsylvania because I might have been drafted. And it was the time of the Vietnam War, and you didn't want to be. So I filled in by going to the Johns Hopkins School of International Studies Center in Bologna. How do we start this? I lost my train.
I'm sorry, I was just asking about Oxford, really, and your university experiences
yes.
after Westminster.
And a guy called John Penny, who in fact supervised my MPhil thesis, who became a don at Wolfson College and was number two on the comparative philology totem pole, he had an English-speaking union scholarship, I think, and did a master's at Penn. And he said, "Well, you know, after the last year of grades, you didn't really have to work very hard." I mean, I actually did, because I did economic history, on the advice of a friend of my father's. I think they were both governors of the LSE. And he said, your maths won't be good enough to do the straight economics, so do economic history and you'll get basic economics. And I did. So we were both doing masters, but different. And his was in classics, and he said it really wasn't very hard work. I mean, I did find it hard work, because the economics was, I mean, the history was a doddle. But the economics, that was quite hard work.
So let's go backwards and talk about classics at Westminster then. So you were taught by Theo?
Yes. I forget who I was taught by my first year, a chap who later became a headmaster who was delightful, but didn't make much impression. I mean, we were competently taught. You know. Then I had Dennis Moynan, who was a very good teacher, not inspirational, but quite strict, and he taught us accentuation, which I tell you, at my time in Oxford, even the Wykamists didn't know. Or tempora or mores. And you know, if you want to know, I corrected the Honor Moderations Greek Unseen papers one year, because I was asked to, and I thought it would be good for my teaching, and it was. And there were several times when they got things wrong because they didn't know the accentuation. So he's a good teacher. And he would give credit. I mean, once there was an unseen, and there was the word sclerae, which is it's the feminine nominative singular of an adjective meaning hard. And I said, and it was a woman, so I said, brazen huffy. And it was something, the only time he ever said, yeah, well done. So then he could. But Theo was terrific because he loved Greek and Latin literature, and you know, and transmitted that.
So, what was a typical lesson like with Theo?
Well, quite discursive. There were his pet words, the Stimmung, which is German, I suppose, for an atmosphere. And let's face it. And so he would tend to go off into a tangent, and he was atheist and didn't conceive. I mean, he didn't ram it down your throat. I was never confirmed because I was having doubts anyway. But when he would quote a bit of Latin or Greek, and it's something like, I may have got it wrong, it's something like, O hutos hutos oedipus timelumen, panaigar ede tada su radinetai, and it's presumably from the Oedipus Victolonus. Oedipus, Oedipus, and it's the god speaking, why are we delaying? For your affairs have been dragging on already for a long time, which is just before he dies. It says in some, I think in his obituary, that the greats didn't really do it for him, which was then a very rigid course. It was ancient history and philosophy, and that was the latter, just more than a half of the classics course at Oxford. And the first course was languages and literature, which is what really engaged him. And I say, out of probably then 8 papers, he got 3 alphas, I heard, at his funeral, meaning absolutely nothing wrong at all. And I tell you, in those days, I mean, we read a lot of Latin and Greek. I mean, I read the whole of Homer and Virgil. But in those days, I think they read the whole of Cicero and Demosthenes as well. I mean, those were the days when people really, really knew the languages. So he was an inspirational teacher and brought across a very liberal attitude. A great man. It was a privilege to be taught by him.
And he did more than just the lessons in the classroom. Presumably it was he that took you on some of those trips to Greece?
Yes, he and Ted Craven. Yes, I only went once, and I heard the Nick Bevan recording that you did. And it was great, and I fell in love with Greece because, it was the time when the Oxford archaeologists had all been dressed up as Greek shepherds and were working for SOE. And the professor of Greek history then was Tony Andrews. And I read Patrick Lee Firmus' books, which, he was... he'd been to Greece before the war and spoke good Greek, and he was a liaison officer with the guerrillas on Crete. And I said to Tony Andrews, did you know? Oh, yes, he said. And Wigfall loved him, flamboyant character like that. So, you know, that was all there. And I can remember reading in New College Library the obituary in the Journal of Hellenic Studies or something of Pendlebury, who had been an archaeologist for a time, spending the winter at Tell el Amarna in Egypt. And you should read the memoir by the secretary of the day called Nefertiti Lived Here, and then in the summers in Knossos. Yeah, and he was a liaison officer, and he was shot by the Germans. So, so you know, all that was very much in the air. And I think when I went there, Cyprus had brewed up, but you know they weren't going to take it out on young people. It clearly wasn't our fault. No, they were lovely people, the Greeks. I can remember. I went with Peter Metcalf, the friend who whose ancestors got to America before mine, in our first long vacation. We went to Greece, and we both took Greek sculpture as a special subject because he got a £60 travelling grant, which paid for the whole lot most of the days. And you know, you went on the buses, and you asked whether Mrs. So and Mrs. Papadopoulos had a room to let you, and you got some very interesting stories. I can remember once a very nice woman. I think it was she who said, "Christos Mazisu, Christ be with you," when she left and gave me a sprig of basil, which is what you did at parting. And I said, "So where were you brought up?" And she said, "Trebizond." And of course, in the after Greco-Turkish War, there was the exchange of populations. So. Didn't notice anything funny about her Greek. I mean, apparently Pontic Greek is supposed to be funny, but she probably came to Greece as a child. So as far as I could, yeah, I didn't speak like the Greek. Didn't notice anything odd about it.
And were those your first travels abroad with the school?
No, my father was a great Francophile. He'd after Cambridge, he went to Sciences Po for a year. And the family through whom my parents met were Americans living in Paris. So he spoke good French, and we went to France several times. My mother was very interested in our history, and we went to Italy, I think, certainly before I went to Greece. So then we did this. I don't think it was... Well, while I was still at school, we'd certainly been to France, Italy, and Austria. Yeah, so...
And, of course, the other thing that Theo's known for is the play.
Oh,
the
yes.
The Russian play.
Yes, well... Yes, it was fun. And since I've always liked the sound of my own voice, I think I was okay at acting. I was never going to be Laurence Olivier, but it was all right. You know, it's funny. I watched the clips that you kindly sent me, and I have to say, although the Latin was impeccable, well, if I were doing it, I think the Latin would be a little closer to how it would have been pronounced. But in those terms, it was impeccable. All the quantities were correct and so on and so on. I thought the acting was a bit wooden. My daughters went to Notting Hill and Ealing, which is one of the GDST schools, and they had a proper drama department. And the acting there, I have to say, was better than the clips of those two. But to find people who are good actors and know Latin well enough that they can memorise the stuff, not easy. And getting more and more difficult, I guess, as time went on and classics became less and less mainstream.
I think fashions have changed a bit too in what's expected of the performance, even in
yes, maybe,
that
yeah,
period
sure.
Too.
Yeah. I mean, I know when we took the play to Mainz just after the end of term, because it was supposedly the 2000th anniversary of the foundation of the city of Mainz. So how anybody knows, I wonder. And so we gave certainly one, maybe two performances, and we prided ourselves on our naturalistic performance. But the review in the German paper said, of course, we loved the fact that they were consciously copying the stylized performance of no comedy in Japan. I thought, didn't get it across.
Did they teach you any other languages? Cause I knew you
yes, Russian.
Oh,
you heard that bit.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Which, well, let me repeat for the oral history. As you heard when I spoke at the memorial for Peter Brown in Oxford. Between our getting scholarships and leaving, we had two terms of Russian with Theo. And he was a native speaker. I don't actually think he was as good at teaching Russian as he was at teaching Latin and Greek. I mean, it's a different technique teaching a modern language. And it's a hard language. I mean, I think Sanskrit's worse, but you know, they both have eight cases. I don't think Russian has a dual, but it does a hell of a lot of grammar. And I wish I'd gone on. Funny enough, I was looking at my old last school report, and he said, and I hope he goes on with Russian, and I didn't, and I'm ashamed of myself, really, because of this beautiful literature, and it's a lovely language, but it's hard. Like, it's probably a bit late now.
It's never too late.
Well, you know, they won't teach you a hard language after the age of 37 at GCHQ. And I took up Sanskrit at the age of 54, and I just scraped through. Yeah, and it's close enough to Greek that it shouldn't be that hard, but... Yeah.
It's probably some of it stored.
Yes, I forgot Devanagari in about 2 years. I mean, I still... Because he mostly worked in transcription. I mean, if I look at a Sanskrit word, I can probably tell more or less what kind of part of speech it is and so on. It's about that time.
Would you explain a little bit, because I think some of the people who listen to the recording perhaps won't properly understand the process for going to university at that stage. So you sat a scholarship exam whilst you were still at school?
Yes. If you were going to be put up for a scholarship exam at Oxbridge, I took A-level Latin and Greek at 15. I took S-level, which was Latin, Greek and Ancient History, at 16, and when I was 17 and a quarter, just before Christmas of my last year at school, I went for scholarship exams at New College. And then it was that there were three rounds of colleges, or three groups of colleges, and if you didn't get a scholarship and were offered, say, only at a place at a college you didn't particularly want to go to, then you did the second one, and so on. So I think probably it was, I mean, I'm guessing, but the three all-round academic colleges at Oxford in those days were, I think, New College, Magdalen and Balliol, and I'm guessing, but I suspect that there was a group, and that those were the three. Theo sent a lot of people to Corpus, where the chair of Latin is, and is... now, and I guess always probably has been for hundreds of years, I'm in a crack classics college. So, yeah. And the Liberty boy in my year got a scholarship to Corpus. Second one, I don't think he got a scholarship, he got an exhibition at St John's. I got a scholarship to New College. Fourth guy went to Clare, Cambridge. Fifth one got a closed scholarship to Christ Church, and the last one was at New College. I don't think was a scholarship. So.
And then after that, you come back to school for.
Well, then I yes. Had I not been captain of the school, I would have left because I was offered a job being a tour guide in Greece, which I would have liked. But my father said no. He said, you know, the deal was you'd stay on, so you stayed on. I said, yeah, exactly. So I did, and it was. I think it would have been better for me as a person to see a bit more of the world. But, you know, I learnt a bit of Russian, certainly improved my French, because I went to some of the French A-level classes. Got to act in the Latin play, which was fun. I got to act in Samuel Beckett play. I mean, I didn't waste my time.
And what were your responsibilities like as captain of the school?
Well, mostly administrative, I think. I mean, I can remember in college hall once, shouting at the people because they were behaving badly, but on the whole, there wasn't much of that. You occasionally put up a notice saying, you know, boys must not play ball in yard or something like that. There was quite a lot of admin. For the first time in my life, and it would have stayed with me, I actually had to make a list every evening of what I got to do the next day, and it was on a bit of paper and it was by my bed. Very good for me. And I worried a bit, because it probably took quite a lot of time. And, yeah, I was taking a scholarship exam. But it all worked out. But, yeah.
Did you feel that you had a certain responsibility to the younger boys within the within college or within the school?
Yes. You know, there were romantic friendships. I mean, I never interfered in any of that because I was damn sure that nobody was going to make anybody do what he didn't want to. As far as I know, there was absolutely nobody. And I suppose those are the two things I would have looked out for. It was pretty good. I mean, I was quite pleased once. There was a guy called Victor Bulmer-Thomas, who went on to a distinguished career as an economist, I think, who was small, and he was in his first year, and I forget which term it was, he came back with a heavy trunk, and I sort of naturally took the other end and helped him take it up. And Theo said, "So whose trunk was that?" And I said, "Well, his, of course." And he said, "Yeah, well, quite right." So, you know, it was not at all Tom Brown school days or any nonsense like that. So is this the kind of thing you want?
Yeah,
or am I talking too much?
No, it's perfect.
Well, as you know, I like the sound of my own voice.
I was going to ask about food, which some people remember and some people don't have no recollections of at all.
It was okay. I mean, at my pre-prep school, we still went for about the first year to a British restaurant, which is absolutely vile. And I think I may have suffered a bit from school phobia or something, because I can remember there being sick quite a lot. And at my prep school, the food wasn't too bad. I mean, although I was sick there, but I absolutely hated it and had to be forced to eat. And at Westminster, if you didn't want to eat it, you didn't eat it. You could always fill up on bread and margarine, Marmite, or whatever the deal was for tea. So, no, it was fine. It was quite good, I thought. Yeah, good breakfast, porridge, all that good stuff.
And one of the other things I wanted to ask, which again, some people seem to remember and other people don't remember at all, is what was the state of some of the buildings? Because they were still repairing school, presumably, when you started?
I don't honestly remember. I mean, it certainly wasn't as it is now. I don't ever remember seeing building work going on. I mean, it wasn't falling down. I mean, it was stabilised. I suspect there wasn't the money to do much more. It was presumably before the Milne donation came in.
Because college, of course, would have one of the first priorities and was reopened before, long before you arrived.
Yes.
So
my brother was in Wrens, which was then the
underneath.
Sort of the ground floor, and college was the first floor. I don't remember particularly. I mean, in somebody's memoirs it says, well, the clerk of the works had to, you know, put on a play rehearsal in one room and then 5 minutes later put it over for fencing and so on. I wasn't aware of any of that. What I do remember is the awful drudgery of having to go to Grove Park suburban playing fields for football and cricket, because I wasn't very good. So I mostly didn't get to go to Vincent Square. And I don't know now why I didn't row. That would have been the obvious thing. I wanted to fence, and my father wouldn't let me because he said, team games. Actually, quite unlike him, but yeah. That, I remember, was a real bitch, because walking to Charing Cross Station, then walking the other end, and it took so long. That, I suppose, is the main gripe. As soon as I could, I think I took up squash, which I wasn't particularly good at, but it was quick. You know, I forget where we went. Dolphin Square or somewhere, I think. And you know, if you ran around and long enough, you could keep up a rally. There was fives, which I enjoyed. Giles Corran did, until recently at least, come back to play fives at Westminster. How unlikely is that?
One of the few places where there are still fives courts in
That's
London,
right.
too.
Yes.
And was there much music going on?
Oh, yes. An awful lot. I was made to keep on playing the piano until I was 14 or 15, and then eventually I said to my parents, look, it's an awful waste of a talented teacher, Arnold Foster. And so I gave up. Much later, because my younger daughter was a very good flautist, grade 8 at 14, no less, I took up the flute, and I'm still actually having lessons. What there was, not necessarily particularly well taught, but you did learn a lot, was choral singing. So my first term, I suppose you had some kind of test, and it was discovered I could sing, and my sight reading was and remains lousy. And we sang, I think, the Bach Magnificat my first term, which I knew well, because I was first a treble, then an alto, and in the last couple of weeks a bass, as my voice broke. So there was a lot of that. There was house singing stuff. There was Madrigal Society, which I still remember with pleasure. You know, Never Weather Beaten Sail. I have a recording of Barbara Bonney singing it. I was reminded by Leslie Brown, Peter's widow, because she was trawling through the online Elizabethan, that I won the Broken Voice singing competition, singing Indecent Heiligen Hallen from The Magic Flute. I went with Simon Morrison, who was head of music, to Glyndebourne the first time and borrowed Henry Christie's dinner jacket, and we saw The Magic Flute at Glyndebourne. I can't remember if that was before or after I went in for the singing competition. So yes, there was a lot, and it was very much approved of, and yeah, it was good. So this is an arty school, probably always has been, so the acting and the singing were absolutely encouraged, quite rightly.
Did you do anything else, like debating or anything?
No, I don't think it was much of that. I went in for the London School's Latin and Greek speaking competitions, and I was robbed, because in the Greek there was a bit of homework which I could do, and then there was, I don't know, somebody's dialogue, and it's The Boring Man, and I played it for laughs, and they said, no, you're only second because it's supposed to be boring. Peasants. The punchline is, when he says, Ktesa Hemesa, yesterday I threw up. Well, you know, you can play it for laughs, which I did. So yes, there was that. Not debating, I don't remember.
And the other thing I was going to ask if you remembered was when the Queen visited
yes.
In 1960.
I can remember, were you supposed to say ma'am or ma'am? And having to sort of help polish the brass plates in college. I mean, I suppose I saw her, I didn't remember much about it. I wasn't, I think Nick Bevan had to sort of dress up in knee breeches and stuff. But, yeah. I did go to Princess Margaret's wedding. Pity it didn't last, the marriage didn't last, but hey.
So. Was it a lot of waiting around in the Abbey? Or?
Yeah, probably, yeah. But yeah, we were used to that. At least for the Sundays that you had to process in Abbey. Yeah, I wasn't a complete nerd. I went on an arduous training camp in the Cairngorms when I was 16 or so.
With Ronald French?
Yes, probably Ronald French. Certainly Denny Brock and Geoffrey Shepherd. And it was very competently done. I mean, I can map read now. I don't think I could there, but I just tagged along. And it was... I mean, in theory, I'm very fond of hill walking, but I would never want to do it again. It was £50 on your back, 12 miles a day, snow on the ground, and put up your own tent. Yeah. We were the most remote census in the British Isles, it must have been 61, 12 miles from the nearest road. And the man who took the census was the park ranger, who had a deerhound called, a wolfhound, I think, called Rory. He used to go through the tents, seeing whether there was any food, which there wasn't. I remember, did you have hires in Gaelic? No. How many outside loos did you have? 12 of us, so we put 12. Yes. So yes, otherwise I think I pretty much was a nerd, you know. Artsy.
And then, just to wrap up, one of the things I like to ask people is to talk a little bit about what they went on to do after leaving Westminster, after leaving education.
Okay, well, I went to Oxford and read Greek. Then, as I said, I did a diploma in Bologna at the Johns Hopkins School of International Studies Centre there. And it was very interesting. I made good friends there, some of whom I still have. There were 50 Europeans and 50 Americans, and I think one Indonesian. And most of them wanted to go on to be diplomats. Now I think it would be international banking or development agencies. Almost all the Europeans learnt some Italian, and hardly any of the Americans did. And it was very interesting, and I'm against Brexit. One reason, we went on a study tour of the European institutions, and you know, the common market was getting going, and the common agricultural policy was being established. And I can remember saying to an American friend of mine, he's now also a dual national, he's quite anti-Brexit because he believes in the Anglosphere. And I said, my first afternoon at Bologna, an American girl, fazed by the strange accent, said, well, are you European? And I hesitated. And at the end of the year, I said yes, because although I liked the Americans, they were all, you know, the assumptions were far more right-wing. And then I did go and take up my my scholarship and did a master's in economic history at the University of Pennsylvania, which was a funny year because it was, well, I know I'm half American and I'm very fond of my cousins, but it didn't make you very pro-American. And when I was there, the Vietnam War was raging. The black people were burning down the cities. Martin Luther King was shot. Bobby Kennedy was shot. Not a great advertisement for the American Army. And I can remember sitting in the university library and reading the front page of the New York Times where the American Army lieutenant said, we had to destroy the village in order to save it. So then I left and was offered three jobs, one by a little American investment bank called White Well, which was later taken over by, I think, Credit Suisse, and the civil service, where I passed the exam, but only for the Department of Transport, which I think was very interesting. And then I said to the Bank of England, got the arrogance, I said, right, I said, well, if you'll put me in the common market group on the overseas department, I'll join you, otherwise not. And they did, to be fair. And I lasted there 5 years, and it was clear I was never going to get to the top. I mean, they were very good. They give you development reports and the forecast. I thought, well, the hell with this. And it was pretty rigid and hierarchical. So then I went to work for a merchant bank called Kleinwort Benson, initially in the American department with European subsidiaries of American companies. But actually there my languages weren't much point because, of course, those American subsidiaries, they all spoke English. And I quickly fell out with the head of the department. And then I joined the department where you had to speak a Latin language. So I did France, Belgium and Italy. And I'd learnt some Italian at Bologna. And, you know, if you know French and Latin, Italian isn't very difficult. And I quickly learnt a lot more because in those days, if you wanted to get business in Italy outside the big cities, you had to speak Italian. So, quickly. I mean, I don't think my written Italian would ever be great, but my spoken Italian, except for something very, very technical like currency swaps, was fine. And we got quite a lot of business, and I enjoyed it. I mean, the most enjoyable part of my career. And then I was the deputy managing director of the subsidiary in Hong Kong because the head of the banking department then was a chap called Martin May Smith. And it was the time of the Latin American debt crisis. And the big bosses had been to the IMF World Bank symposium in Washington and heard Latin countries are going to get into trouble, which actually meant Latin America. And they said, well, Italy's a Latin country, you know, prove to us it's not going to go past. And if you'd done some macroeconomics and you'd been to the Bank of England, you could do that stuff. And that impressed the head of banking then, who picked me for the job in Hong Kong. While he was there, there was a coup, and my old enemy became the head of it. It was very clear that I had to find somewhere else. So after only 2 years in Hong Kong, I came back. And the investment management people wanted me to do marketing because I'd got them a deal on the side in Italy when Unit Trust first came in. I got them a big international, or I introduced them and they got a big international investment contract there. So then I spent, I suppose, 6 years doing that. And then the head of compliance in the investment management department was another man with an American mother. And I was pretty rigid, having 400 years of Puritan blood in my veins and ex-central banker. So if you had to get an advertisement in for approval on time, I got it in on time. And so he recommended me for the job as his successor, which I did for 4 years. And then Climates was taken over by Dresdner Bank, and we were put under the management control of a firm in San Francisco that they'd taken over a couple of years before. And my boss was an American lawyer who was very difficult. And a lot of people had stress. I don't know how people actually got nervous breakdowns. A lot of people left. Eventually he left. He was got rid of course. Clearly he was an impossible man to work with. My deputy got shingles, which at a young age, which is stress related. So as soon as it was clear that I could just about survive on my early pension, I left. And I'd always been interested in the history of languages. I wanted to learn Basque when I was 15, but there were no books because Franco didn't believe in it. So I remember we went and lived in our cottage in Berkshire. I remember sitting in Newbury Public Library looking at all the prospectuses, and it might have been an MA at Reading in the Italian literature at the time of Dante, but actually there was an MPhil in History of Indo-European Languages at Oxford, and so I wrote in for that, and they took me, and as I said at Peter's Memorial, he very kindly gave me an academic reference, but the number two on the totem pole was a man who had been the year below me at New College, who was at the University of Pennsylvania with me, and he must have said, I had no idea whether he can still do it, but he could do Latin and Greek then, so why not, it's all money, so they took me. And so then I did the MPhil, and then I did the DPhil over several years, and I think my wife has just about forgiven me because I neglected her. And for the last 3 years of my DPhil, and then for several years afterwards, 9 years in total, I taught Latin and Greek translation both ways at Somerville College, because my professor's chair was at Somerville, she being a woman, and in those days you had to go to Wilkins College. And she knew I knew Latin and Greek, so yeah, and it's pretty technical. So, which was fun, and you didn't, on the whole, get the best students. But there was one girl who'd been homeschooled, and she really knew Latin and Greek. Her mother had read Mods, and she knew the accents, and she got, I think she was number two in the Latin Prose Composition Prize. Only because an Italian who was 30 years old and who technically had only matriculated the year before picked her at the post. And she is still doing a doctorate in Sanskrit at UCLA. There was another girl who is half Swiss and bilingual in French. And she came in a bit of a panic one day and said, "Help!" I said, "Yeah, what's the problem?" So, "I've got an interview with Baker McKenzie for an internship in 3 days' time, and they want me to analyse an article in the FT that morning." So I said, "Fine." Coffee shop next morning, 3 hours, several cups of coffee, and I took her from the Gold Standards onwards, and she's now working for Baker McKenzie. And I wrote her a reference to join the Irish Bar Association, because since she can speak French, if Brexit goes ahead, actually I'm not sure that's going to be as useful as Baker McKenzie thinks, but they need people to do it now. So it was fun. And then my brother was very ill up in Edinburgh, and my health was suffering a bit, and I wanted to do some research, and I was doing too much teaching, so I resigned. I mean, they asked me to stay on past retirement age, but I thought, you know, enough's enough. So, and then we're still living in Oxford. And occasionally I do some research, but not as much as I should. So, that's...
And is there anything that you would like to say that I haven't given you the opportunity to say? Anything you think I should have asked you?
I think what would strike me now would be the difference between how much money you had to have then, or your parents had to have, and how much you have to have now. And I know Patrick Durham is doing great work and wants to make the school needs blind, and good for him. You know, my father went to Newbury Grammar School and not gone on exhibition to Cambridge and never looked back. But it was pretty solid professional middle classes when I was there. And then there was a young woman who was a colleague of mine at Kleinwort's. And 5 or 6 years ago, my wife had her to lunch in Oxford because her son was coming up to read law and he'd been up grants. And I said, "But Antonia, you know, you're not working. How do you afford it?" I said, "Oh, my husband's a hedgie." "Well, good for them." you know, and got into Oxford to read law. I mean, clearly he's not stupid to know that well at all. But I think that's a regrettable difference. When I had a couple of old Westminster pupils at Somerville, and I don't think their parents were particularly rich. There was one, she was a girl of Chinese extraction, and her parents were both consultant surgeons, and her brother had been there. You know, I'm sure they could do it on the salary. But that was several years ago. I wonder now, I'm not so sure. So that, I think, is the only thing that comes to mind that I should wish to be on record. Any other questions, as they say?
No, I think that's a nice conclusion. Really.
Good. Okay, well, thank you very much. That's been fun.
Thank you.